Policy Committee to order. Ms. Hansen, please take the roll.
Absolutely. Chair Schultz.
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner.
Present.
Present. Lead Albright.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Burkle.
Present.
Representative Fisher.
Fisher, present.
Good morning. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hansen.
Present.
Thank you. Representative Keel is excused today. Representative Liebling. Representative Moeller.
Present.
Representative Moore.
Present.
Thank you. Representative Novotny.
Novotny is present.
Good morning. Representative Pearson.
Pearson, present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, present.
Thank you. Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Sandel.
Present.
And Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, we have a quorum. Representative Bonner, would you like to move the minutes from March 5th?
I would be honored to move the minutes from March 5th.
Thank you, Vice Chair Bonner. Are there any questions or discussions? Corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes from March 5th, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the minutes from March 5th, 2021 are approved. Okay, members, a few announcements. We have to end early today because we have a floor session at noon and they need to use, House Information needs to use the streaming. So we're gonna end 5 minutes early. We have many bills on our agenda, so please be considerate of your questions and comments. So the first bill we have for consideration is House File 821, and I'm not seeing any amendments. And this bill will be, House Bill 821 will be laid over for possible inclusion, and I move that it be before our committee. So Representative Kegel, welcome back to the committee. Please tell us about House Bill 821.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House Bill 821 was a bill that I kind of authored out of frustration, I guess. During the first CARES Act stimulus package, flex spending accounts for HSAs and healthcare accounts were able to be rolled over into the 2021 year without all the money was able to be rolled over. And so I know a lot of us have dependent care accounts that we can use for childcare, daycare, and due to the pandemic, a lot of people pulled their kids out of daycare. And so I had worked with the federal delegation over the summer to make sure that dependent care accounts were actually included in the next stimulus package. And so I worked a lot with both our senators and Congressman Emmer's office was very, very helpful. And I worked with them to make sure that we got this dependent care account rollover into the second federal legislation. So when that bill came back, it actually allowed employers to opt into that and not just have it automatically roll over. And so that means that, the dependent care money that's sitting in the account from 2020 may or may not be rolled over into 2021, depending on the employer. And so, I reached out to our HR and MMB to advocate that our plan have the 2020 dependent care account money automatically rolled over. And for me and my family, that was $820 that was sitting in that account. That's almost a month of daycare expenses. And so it was a huge help to us for us to have that money rolled over. And so I just want to make sure that, all Minnesotans get that option to use the money that they have put aside. It's their money that is taken out of their paychecks and put into account, that money is there for them. And so that's really just what this bill does, is asks that the accounts be rolled over into 2021.
Thank you, Representative Kegel. Any questions for members? Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, Representative Kegel,
notwithstanding your presentation. So what is the sunset provision for FSAs under the most recent COVID stimulus package?
Representative Cagle?
It's Cagle, sorry.
Cagle, sorry.
That's okay. Everybody jokes. I should have just stuck with Anderson. I don't know what the sunset is in the federal legislation. I don't know if maybe House staff can help out.
Do we have anyone from DHS here? I believe we do. Well, I may have to get back to you on that, Representative Albright.
That would be fine. Representative Cagle, based upon your presentation, so we aren't necessarily needing to request a waiver because it's included in the COVID stimulus package, because you are affecting a change to ERISA, which is under Section 125 of the Internal Revenue Code. Is that your understanding as well?
Representative Cagle?
Madam Chair, yes.
Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you could just get back to make sure that we're conforming with Section 125 from the COVID-19 Relief Act, I would appreciate it.
We will do that, Representative Albright. Okay, any other questions from members? Any closing comments, Representative Cagle?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. You know, I just think this is, you know, this is money that people have put in their accounts out of their paychecks, and it should just be rolled over because of unforeseen circumstances. We want to make sure that people have access to their money. So thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. So House File 821 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. Next on our docket is, for consideration, is House File 947. Representative Pinto, would you like to move your bill before the committee and confirm the recommendation that it be placed on the general register?
Yes, that is my motion, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Moves to place House File 947 on the general register. So we have the bill before us. Representative Pinto, please tell us about House File 947, and I don't see any amendments.
That is correct, Madam Chair. I don't believe that there are any. House File 947 contains several changes to how our state addresses juvenile, both young people being held in custody, and that's really an area that was heard in the Public Safety Committee. I think that the focus for this committee is towards the end of the bill. I guess I'll confirm that with you, Madam Chair, but I believe that the focus for Human Services is just the portion of the bill that changes the age at which youth can be charged with delinquency crimes, or have that go through the juvenile delinquency path, potentially age 10 to age 13. I can provide more information on that from our testifiers. Maybe I'll just confirm that that is the focus for our committee's jurisdiction.
We do like to focus on the sections of the bill that are relevant to our jurisdiction, so I believe you are correct, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In that case, then, I think what I'd like to do is just turn to my testifiers for some more explanation about the bill.
Okay. The first testifier we have is Curtis Shanklin. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and your title or affiliation for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Curtis Shanklin. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Corrections, where I oversee our Reintegration and Restorative Services Division. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak to you all today about this important piece of legislation. When we talk about criminal justice reform or transformative change, it is important to note two elements, which I believe are extremely vital to achieving either of those two aspirations. One being the usual elephant in the room, which is the racial and ethnic disparities that exist within the system. Unfortunately, here in Minnesota, we're not immune to that, particularly when we talk about our youth involved in the juvenile justice system. The reality is that 75% of the youth who are arrested in Minnesota are for not what we consider are more serious violent homicides or first-degree assaults. The vast majority of them are for what we consider our Part II offenses, which is our lesser persons or property crimes. Those Native American and American Indian kids who we arrest in Minnesota and place in out-of-home placement are done at rates that place Minnesota near the top in the nation when we talk about racial and ethnic disparities. Those Black and African American kids we arrest and place in secure detention are done at rates here in Minnesota that also place us near the top in the nation when we talk about racial and ethnic disparities. We also have our kids out in greater Minnesota who are dealing with chemical dependency and mental health issues that at times we are forced to continually inappropriately use secure detention because our local law enforcement partners and members of the courtroom state work group do not have the resources they need that will allow them to provide the proper setting and resources that are needed to address the issues that those youth are dealing with. And again, the other element of that, when I talk about achieving those two aspirations, is having an intentional focus to ensure that our youth are both a part of these reform and transformative change efforts. This is why we encourage not only just community members, but criminal justice stakeholders, when they think about our justice-involved youth, to do that through the My Child test, which essentially states that if your daughter or son, your granddaughter or grandson, your niece or nephew made a poor choice or was with a group of youth who made a poor choice, how would you want their treatment and experience to be within the juvenile justice system? I would just care to guess that you would want it to first ensure that their needs are met, that they are held appropriately accountable, but more importantly, that their experience is one that will really mitigate or ensure that they have no further contact with the criminal justice system in its entirety. And when we start using the My Child test, we also begin to think about those kids as our kids. And when we start to really think about those kids as our kids, then I feel like we're probably more willing to work with a sense of urgency, that we're more than willing to stay at work a little bit later, that we're more than willing to look at the issues that they're dealing with through a lens that provides a little bit more empathy, a little bit more grace, and a little bit more humanity. And I think we're willing to truly analyze how might historical trauma and victimization play a role in the choices that some of those youth are making today. Those kids deserve better because, again, those kids are our kids, and we can do better. I think it's imperative that we do better, and we can do this right now. This provision is part of a juvenile justice legislative platform that we put together that provides legislators and lawmakers that opportunity, an opportunity to show Minnesotans that even in a divided legislature, we can come together across party lines and get meaningful work accomplished, that the needs of our youth here in Minnesota really transcend party lines. And I think this is evident in the bipartisan support that we've received by this bill. When it was first introduced in the Public Safety Committee, it passed with nearly unanimous support. I think there was only one nay with that. Representative Novotny, who I believe is a member of this committee, has shown great leadership along with other representatives, from Representative Polston to Representative Mueller and others who have all signed on to these bills. Because our kids mean that much. Their future means that much. But more importantly, their lives mean that much. And I cannot think of a more important issue that deserves our urgent attention than the lives of our future leaders of tomorrow. And every day that goes by that we don't act with a sense of urgency, with determination, with intentionality, is a day that goes by that we ultimately don't believe in those kids as we do our kids, that we don't love those kids as we do our kids, that we ultimately don't value those kids as we do our kids. And as I have said numerous times, just to put it frankly, that is not one Minnesota. And so, Madam Chair, with that, I'll conclude my testimony. I'll be available for questions. I know another colleague of mine, Sarah Davis, who's the executive director at the Legal Rights Center, will be available for questions. And also my colleague, who I will be passing on to, Katrina Dexter, who's our director of our Juvenile Justice Reform Unit, who will provide her testimony, will also be available for questions, too. So thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Shanklin. The next testifier is Katrina Dexter. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify regarding this important legislation. My name is Katrina Dexter, and I am the Director of Juvenile Justice Reform at the Department of Corrections. Today, I'm here to testify on House File 947. First and foremost, I want to thank the members, both Republican and Democrat, who have already signed on to author this bill. I want to frame my testimony in the understanding of what we know is best practice in juvenile justice, as well as adolescent brain development. And that is really the foundation of what we created these bills upon. With that being said, I want to transition my testimony to speak to the current bill and the provisions within that apply to the jurisdiction of this committee. I'll keep my testimony limited, as I know you have a full agenda today. The bill before us now is House File 947 and is authored by Representative Pinto. There are six sections or provisions of the bill. The first two sections are technical language changes. The second two provisions are regarding conditions of confinement in facilities licensed by the Department of Corrections, ending visual strip searches and solitary confinement of juveniles. The last two sections are regarding age limitations in the juvenile justice system, setting the delinquency age as well as the detention admission eligibility age to 13. The sixth and final section of the bill will be the focus of my testimony today as it falls within the jurisdiction of this committee. The provision, this provision will raise the age of delinquency from 10 to 13. Currently, if you are 10 years old and you participate in behavior that would be classified as a delinquent behavior, you are served by the juvenile justice system. This section raises that age to 13. Still wanting to ensure our youth and their families are being provided services. However, those services should be provided by a system that is more appropriate to work with youth who are younger, such as the child welfare system. When we know there are lifelong consequences that come with involvement in the juvenile justice system, as well as having a delinquency record, we must ensure that our youngest youth are served by a system that does not have such consequences. This concludes my testimony on House File 947, Madam Chair, and I will be available for questions, and I would just want to say thank you again for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Dexter, for your testimony. Yes, I was surprised to learn that was age 10, and surprised that we hadn't changed that earlier. So thank you for your testimony. Members, do you have any questions for the testifiers or for the bill author, Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure which of the testifiers or to the author of the bill. Good morning, Representative Pinto. I know that this had a fairly thorough vetting in public safety, so I'm maybe going to go over some already plowed ground, but I think it's important for this group as well. We're raising it from 10 to 13, while many other states are at 12. This would definitely make us, quote unquote, the leader or an outlier, as it were, in terms of the max age for a juvenile. How do you respond to that?
Representative Pinto?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Lead Albright, and good morning to you too. I guess it seems like we first just, and I'll be interested to get the testifiers' input as well, but my thinking is that we really want to be driven by the best understanding of brain development. And I think just even at a common sense level, as we all think about it, think about a 12-year-old versus a 13-year-old, a reminder that what this will say then is that children up to age 12 are going to be directed to the child welfare system, even if they've committed a delinquent act. Somebody 13 or over is going to be directed to that system that goes all the way up to age 18. And just to think that the delinquency system that ends at, you know, age 17 and 364 days, there's something about, frankly, there's something about a 13-year-old that feels like they may not fit so well in that system, but certainly you'd think once you go down to age 12, that feels like a very different situation for a child to be in. So regardless of what's happening with other states, it seems to me just looking at this, I would hope that we would think that there'd be quite a distinction between 12 and 13-year-olds. And maybe Mr. Shanklin and Ms. Dexter have a comment on this as well.
Sure. Mr. Shanklin or Ms. Dexter? Mr. Shanklin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Albright, for the question. No worries about going over plowed ground. I think this is a good conversation to have. And I'll just kind of reiterate just kind of what Representative Pinto said. I don't think that it's necessarily anything we should shy away from with being leaders in the nation, particularly when it comes to the treatment of our young people. And when we think about those who are justice involved, particularly between that age group, I think it's important for us to, again, make sure that they're going through the proper setting that is ultimately going to address their needs. I think we see this a lot when we see it in the truancy world, which many a times their behavior is an indicator that something more is going on. Myself and Ms. Dexter, who have both worked at juvenile detention facilities, can tell you that not only when we bring a child into that facility, that it increases their likelihood to commit more serious offenses when they leave. Unfortunately, we almost entirely see them again. So I'll see them at 10, I'll see them at 12, I'll see them at 14, and I'll see them at 16, primarily because we're not investing to what is really driving the behavior. And by sending them through the child welfare side gives us an opportunity to not just work with that youth, but to work with the family to find out what are the dynamics there that are really driving the behavior and not just the behavior itself. And I know my colleague, who's the director at the Legal Rights Center, can also maybe speak to, if it's necessary, a little bit about the competency that we see for those youth and their amenability to actually be competent to stand trial, if you also choose and feel that that is necessary. Thank you for the question. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks. Ms. Dexter or Sarah Davis, would you like to comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Albright, thank you for the opportunity. My name is Sarah Davis. I'm the executive director over at the Legal Rights Center. I'm a lawyer, and my entire career has been representing young people in the juvenile justice system. I appreciate the framing of this as being a leader. I just also want to just note that there's 12 states that are also currently looking at legislation to raise the lower age of their juvenile court jurisdiction. So I do think leadership is the appropriate terminology here. And then just internationally, the United Nations Committee on the Rights of the Child notes that 14 is actually the most common age around the world. So what I just want to note is what Mr. Shanklin referenced. So I've been representing kids in the justice system for over 13 years. I've never had a child under the age of 13 been found competent to stand trial by the court. So what that means is when you have a 10, 11, or 12-year-old who comes into the justice system on a delinquency matter, you have a competency evaluation by the court. They're found not competent to stand trial, and the case gets kicked out for at least 6 months. 6 months go by, depending how old they are, how much, you know, are they now 13 or are they still 12 or 11? They're found not competent again. The case gets kicked out for another 6 months. This can go on for years. And while the child's not competent, the court has no, the delinquency court has no jurisdiction to address the underlying behaviors because the child's not competent to stand trial. And so everything that we know about child brain development, right, and if you have your own kids or if you've interacted with young people, is that waiting 6 months, a year, 2 years to address a behavior is completely ineffective and counterproductive. What this would do would say that kids who are not competent and quite frankly don't belong in the delinquency system, the juvenile court can still address the behavior, but they can do it through the child welfare system where there's not that requirement of competency to stand trial, where the behavior can be addressed and dealt with in the context of the family and in the context of providing the services that they need right away and up front. It's really just quite frankly, bad practice. I mean, I can't even begin to explain to you what it feels like to have to sit down with an 11-year-old or 12-year-old and explain the juvenile justice system. They don't understand, and rightfully so. They're too young.
Ms. Davis, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Davis, thank you for that. That was a very helpful question. And I do have a follow-up for you then with regard to just a couple tangential, and thank you for the indulgence, Madam Chair. We often talk about the development of the child and moving it to 13, understanding that. Two questions, a two-part question then. Would there be any exceptions to this discharge of a minor to either custody or to juvenile court at 13? And then what involvement and or participation would parental rights be voided in either a circumstance if the with consideration to the problem not being the parents.
Ms. Davis?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Albright. To your first question, the bill, the legislation raises the minimum, the lower age of juvenile court jurisdiction across the board to 13. So what we know is that youth who are 10, 11, and 12 and engage in behaviors, whether they're relatively minor or more serious behaviors, that they don't belong in the delinquency system. The system is not designed or set up to support those young people. And again, quite frankly, even on the more serious cases, it's even in many ways more important that the court have jurisdiction through the child protection system to be able to provide those supports and services right away, rather than waiting for years for that child to become competent and for the court to be able to move forward on that case. So this is an across the board change. I have to just say, I'm not sure I fully understood the second part of your question about the parental rights. So would you indulge me in just
maybe rephrase it in terms of what involvement from the perspective of understanding what their child is going through and undergoing in the court system, what involvement is denied, or how do the parents participate going forward under this change?
Ms. Davis?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright. So actually under this change, parents would have a lot more involvement. So when kids are charged in the juvenile delinquency system, parents don't have a lawyer. They don't have they don't really have any say in what happens at all, quite frankly. It's the child's case. Whereas if it proceeds under the child protection system, the parents are heavily involved. They may have the right to legal counsel. It's treated as a family matter versus in the juvenile delinquency system. Just give you an example. Like when I have a client who's charged, the parent, you know, unless the child wants them to know what's happening or wants them involved, the parent has no right to get any information from me as the child's lawyer. The parent gets no lawyer. They can come into the court, but only to the courtroom, but only to the extent that the judge is going to explain what's happening, unless the child wants them more involved. And really, when you're talking about kids of this age, 10, 11, and 12, as you all know, it's just really important to have parents or guardians or family involvement in what's happening and engagement in that. So it's another important point, and I appreciate you raising that.
Davis, Representative Albright. Last question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and either for the testifiers or for Representative Pinto. Is there any determination for this based upon the severity of the offense committed by the juvenile?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Albright. Under current law, there's not a distinction, and I'll turn to testifiers in a second. But my understanding is, under current law, we're looking at the child directly, and so we're not making that distinction based on the conduct in that way. We're making it based on the age, and then kind of taking those steps from there. But I guess I'd like to see perhaps Ms. Davis or one of the other testifiers may have a comment on that.
Ms. Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Albright, Representative Pinto. So Representative Pinto is correct. The way the court's jurisdiction is currently set at age 10, there is no distinction based on level of offense, which is appropriate in from a developmental lens. I also will just say the child protection proceedings will maintain jurisdiction over that child for the same length of time as the juvenile delinquency proceedings would. So it's not, this gets a little bit technical and I don't know how much time y'all have, but it's not like a kid who's 12 who currently gets charged in the juvenile delinquency system that the court gets a longer period of jurisdiction over them just because they're charged in delinquency. You have to be 14 in order for you to have the opportunity to have it transferred to become an adult case under Minnesota law. And so similarly, under this provision, the child protection system would still have that same length of jurisdiction over the child and still be able to provide services, whether it's in their home, in their community, or outside of their home based on the judgment of the judge in that case, for the same length of time. And so I don't know how helpful that is. There's a lot of technical details here, but ultimately What this does is it's just a reflection of the way our law is currently written, which is appropriate of saying this is the age at which we believe juvenile court jurisdiction on the delinquency side of things should kick in. It's not based on the offense type. And the last thing I'll add is that this is a little bit of a justice by geography issue. There are some counties where they don't charge kids at these ages in the juvenile delinquency system. They only treat them through the child protection system, but there's other counties who do. And what this would do would make it so that regardless of where you are in Minnesota, that no matter what county you're in, that you have access to the appropriate resources for a kid aged 10, 11, and 12.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. I'm not seeing any more questions. Representative Pinto, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank the testifiers, Ms. Davis, for sharing her expertise. I agree with Representative Albright. That was extremely, extremely helpful. And Mr. Shanklin and Ms. Dexter have really been leading the charge on this, and so grateful. I just want to mention to members before we vote how important I think it is to be recognizing the brain development here and the situation. I would think that many of our constituents would imagine that there would in fact be this distinction between a 12-year-old and under versus 13-year-old, much less where we're at right now in terms of under 10. And just note that of the two committee members with particular public safety background, myself as a prosecutor, Representative Novotny, and actually Representative Mueller as a prosecutor as well, recognizing the support that we have in terms of co-authorship for this bill. And so I really would appreciate your support. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto, and to our testifiers. As a mother of a 12-year-old, I appreciate it even more that you're moving this legislation forward. So members, with that, Representative Pinto renews his motion to place House File 947 on the General Register as recommended. Ms. Hansen, please take the roll call vote. Chair votes aye.
Schultz, aye. Vice Chair Bonner?
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Lead Albright?
Aye.
Albright, aye. Representative Bolden?
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Burkle?
Aye.
Burkle, aye. Representative Fisher?
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hansen?
Hansen, aye.
Hansen, aye. Keel, excused. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Mueller?
Aye.
Mueller, aye. Representative Noor?
Aye.
Noor, aye. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Novotny, aye. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, nay.
Pearson, no. Thank you. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, aye.
Rasmussen, aye. Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Robbins, aye. Representative Sandell?
Aye.
Sandell, aye. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Chair Schultz, that's 17 ayes, 1 nay, 1 excused.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. The motion prevails, and House File 947 will be placed on the General Register. Thank you, Representative Pinto. The next bill we have for consideration is House File 611. I'll move House File 611 so it's before the committee, and it will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. Well, Representative Noor, can you please describe House File 611? And I'm not seeing any amendments.
That's correct, Madam Chair. Thank you. House File 611 increases the gross income limit for broad-based categorical eligibility, also known as BBCE under SNAP, from 165% to 200% federal poverty guideline. Members, SNAP is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. BBCE is a federal policy through which the household may become automatically or categorically eligible for SNAP program. The expanded benefits will be covered through the federal program. This reduces program complexity by simplifying the application and determination process. It also reduces the time spent to process and verifying resources. It also helps us reduce some of the error rate that we previously talked about. However, this does not exclude the applicant or the recipient from program requirements. They must still submit an application, meet the program income eligibility criteria, participate in an interview, and document their financial circumstances, including any future changes. Increasing the SNAP gross income limit helps working families by expanding or extending the benefit cliff. As their earnings rise, they will be able to stay in SNAP program. SNAP supports work in part by phasing the program down gradually. BBCE allows state to lift the gross income threshold and phase benefit out more gradually, which lets households close the threshold and take higher paying incomes and still benefit from the program. This will allow working families to save for the future and build wealth to avoid debt and also to be able to provide enough income for their families. Members, this is a simple request. At this point, the state is at 165. Many states have already changed the federal poverty guidelines to 200%, which is allowable under the federal program. Quite frankly, this will be something that we can help many struggling families to put food at the table. And I ask for your support. I know there are individuals from DHS who are here to support in case I need to answer any questions in regards to the program.
Thank you, Rep. Semenor. It looks like we have one testifier, Peter Wytok from Hunger Solutions. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Peter Wytok, Government Relations with Hunger Solutions Minnesota, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today on House File 611. In order to fully leverage SNAP to address unprecedented levels of food insecurity due to COVID-19, Hunger Solutions worked with partners across the state on a project to explore ways that we could look to improve the SNAP program in Minnesota. And we heard directly from SNAP participants and those experiencing food insecurity through surveys, listening sessions, and key informant interviews. And one issue that emerged out of that work was that there are people on the edge of qualifying, but their income is just above 165% of federal poverty line limit to be eligible in SNAP in Minnesota, who still struggle to feed their families. And many of these families also have incomes that fluctuate in between 165 and 200% of the federal poverty level and cannot afford costs essential to human health, such as food, housing, childcare, and other daily living expenses. So what this bill would do is what Representative Noor explained is what 18 other states have done is use broad-based categorical eligibility to increase the gross income threshold for SNAP to 200% of the federal poverty level. This would leverage more federal funds we're currently leaving on the table and allow more low-income Minnesota families to work, provide food for their families, and continue to move toward economic stability. During a time of increased need, it's critical that we fully leverage SNAP to make sure that low-income Minnesotans have enough food on the table to feed their families. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wytok. Are there any questions from members? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Either for Representative Noor or for the testifier, does the SNAP benefit coordinate with, in terms of payment, with any other federal program?
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think SNAP, as part of the program, we have some of the state TANF program, which is, I think the state DHS staff can answer that question. But mostly for the BBCE, they will be leveraging what the programs we have in the state, like general assistance, some of the recipients who are receiving SSI income. All those individuals come under the category of broad-based categorical eligibility, but I'll let DHS respond to that question.
Yes, if someone from DHS could respond or someone from our research staff. I'm not sure if it's Ms. Sunderman or Ms. Punelli or... here we have DHS. Ms. Sommerfeld, are you there?
I am. Thank you. Yes, and I'm going to actually turn this over to my colleague, Ryan Johnson. He should be up in just a second. So,
okay, Mr. Johnson.
Good morning, Chair Schultz and committee. To answer the Representative Albright's question, we do in Minnesota have a combined, in the Minnesota Family Investment Program, we have a combined benefit between our cash assistance program and our SNAP benefits. So that's the one case in Minnesota where we combine the program between people that receive cash assistance and also receive the food portion of the SNAP benefits as a combined benefit. So That would be one example.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Knorr, my question, and I think maybe that was answered, but my understanding is that SNAP goes up to 130% of the poverty guideline, and then TANF actually pays for the benefit beyond that. And what I was trying to maybe ascertain in terms of if that's the case, are there other benefits that would be provided under TANF that would be supplanted by this increase? And I just have one quick follow-up, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Albright, I don't see any resource that will be supplanted by this increase. This looks into the broad-based categorical eligibility for the SNAP program, which is separate compared to the combination of the unique program we have where NFIP is the cash portion and the TANF combined with the food program.
Mr. Johnson, do you have anything to add to that?
Chair Schultz and Representative Albright, I will just say that the food portion that is provided with the combined MSIP benefit is paid for through SNAP. And this is actually, this change in terms of increasing the gross income limit for SNAP doesn't change eligibility for our Minnesota Family Investment Program.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Knorr, this is a laudable undertaking, and I understand the desire to make sure that, that folks, you know, are able to, you know, feed their families. 2 points for you. I think one of the things that we often hear from advocates for this, and I would encourage people to maybe work on a definition in terms of what does food insecurity really mean? It could mean anything to anyone, but I think it's important when we're crafting legislation that we actually identify what that term legitimately speaks to. And my final point, Madam Chair, and for Representative Knorr, and for the members, it's I understand the desire to increase the cap up to 200%, but what we're really doing, sadly, is we're just extending or postponing the need for other decisions to be made by the family. There is no gradient, as I would understand it. We're just extending out that cliff for the benefit, and afterwards, you've fallen off of it. I'd like to see us take a look at some type of a gradient that would avail people to be able to work at higher income limits and wean themselves off of the SNAP or MFIP or anything else that would supplement that income, because the whole focus of this effort is really to avail and to promote self-support resilience in the face of whatever crisis comes our way. And I understand some are unforeseen, but I would certainly encourage Representative Knorr to think about some type of a graded scale that would alleviate that cliff that we just continue to prolong the problem for these folks just by raising the cap. And now we're there. Now we've got an opportunity to think in other terms as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and Representative Albright. I think there's a definition for food insecurity, which is from the federal government, which states it's defined as the disruption of food intakes or eating patterns because of lack of money and other resources. So looking from that definition and also taking advantage of what is allowable under the federal based on BBCE, that we can raise up to 200% is really something that we can do. And given that we're leaving that resources at the table, as you've had from the testifier, doesn't help us address some of the food insecurity that we've just talked about. Especially during this COVID-19, it really helps us to address and to be able to support those who need help the most. We know many folks who face food insecurity during this time, and they were missing their meals from school and many other places. This was the only option that they had. And if they didn't have that, you know, income-based looking at their income, many of them were not able to put food on the table. And some of the other programs I'm going to be talking about really provides the, you know, covers the gaps that exist in our systems.
Thank you, Representative Knorr. Thank you for those comments. Representative Albright, happy to work with you to push out beyond 200% and provide more food security and income assistance, and also happy to work with you to see if people can work longer hours and not be penalized on their benefits and able to keep their wages and their benefits. I'm not seeing any other questions, so I'm going to lay House File 611 over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next bill we have for consideration is House File 1785. This will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance Bill. So I'm going to move House File 1785 so it's before us. It looks like Representative Knorr, I see that you have an A1 amendment. Would you like to move your amendment to get the bill in the shape you would like it?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Can you just describe quickly the A1 amendment?
The A1 amendment changes the amount that was originally set in this bill from last year. So we've seen the increase. The numbers have jumped up to 34,000. When we started discussing about this bill, we had only 26,000 participants or households who are receiving MFIP, and now it's up to 34,000. So that's the number that changed. We're also changing the dates from 2021 to 2022. And finally, we are removing diversionary work program because most of the folks who are under that program were moved into the MFIP, and it also addresses those who are currently receiving rather than any future recipient for that one-time-only program.
Okay. Representative Knorr moves the A1 amendment to House File 1785. Please unmute yourself. This is a voice vote. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and House File 1785 is amended. So Representative Knorr, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is something that is overdue. Members, we are helping the most needy individuals in our society. When we talk about Minnesota Family Investment Program, we're talking about children. We're talking about kids who are living in poverty. Quite frankly, we want to be able to support all families that no one lives in poverty. But because of the COVID-19 pandemic, we have seen how that it has devastated families in need. We know that this one-time only $500 payment to MFIP participants will really help those individuals. This is not about taking something away or robbing Peter to pay Paul. In fact, it's paying Peter for the dues that are in that program. Quite frankly, these resources are meant to support those individuals who are under this program, really addresses the core values of how we're going to be tackling COVID-19 pandemic. We have seen the need. I know many people say they've got enough resources, they don't need anything. Can you imagine? Can you imagine living in a poverty? Can you imagine young children who need that extra help that they cannot find? Can you imagine folks who are unable to pay their rent when the amount that they have isn't sufficient enough, even with other federal programs that they are eligible, because some of this process, by the time they spend everything, and when help is on the way, we're too late. Quite frankly, we are too late in providing that support to so many families as they have struggled with kids at home, feeding them every single day. We're talking about almost 34,000 households, more than 80,000 are young children, and especially children under the age of 6. We want to support those families who are unable to receive any benefits from their employers. We want to support families who have been impacted by COVID-19. This is a program that will help. And quite frankly, this is also support for our economy. to help individuals to spend that money immediately. As we know, based on the facts and analysis, when you allow individuals from low-income families to receive any benefits or cash assistance, they're going to spend it. And if we're really, truly going to be helping families, it's the families that I need. And I'm asking for your support. I know I do have some individuals who wanted to testify on this bill. I think we can do it. And the only expense under this bill is $31,000 for the computer systems to be able to process this one-time only $500 payment to MFIP recipients. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Noor. I'm not seeing any testifiers listed. You mentioned you have testifiers.
Madam Chair, I see Ms. Webster. I don't know if you wanted to testify on this bill.
Okay, Ms. Webster, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with the Legal Services Advocacy Project. We also refer to that as Legal Aid. And I'm just here to briefly speak in strong support of this bill. And we have supported this emergency payment since last spring and the multiple times that it's come up. And I think just what the only brief point I want to make, because I've been hearing from legislators, well, there's stimulus payments and haven't they haven't lost anything. And, you know, the reality for the families that are accessing the Minnesota Family Investment Program is that they likely lost work right before the pandemic, and they lost it in the same industries that were the hardest hit by the pandemic. So if you ask DEET or DHS for the work histories of these families, it's hotel, restaurant, retail, low-wage in-home healthcare. And so if you lost work in the fall up until January, February, and March, you would not be eligible for unemployment insurance or for pandemic unemployment insurance. And so families that were enrolled in the Minnesota Family Investment Program that just lost work, they lost out on thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars in safety net for unemployed workers. We took care of workers in a really important way that lost work during the pandemic. But these families who had lost work just before the pandemic, we turned our backs on them and we said, well, they're getting $632 a month, which doesn't cover a fair market rent anywhere in the state. And so these families have I just submitted a letter to the governor. I was joined by organizations statewide that represented the faith community, community action agencies, food shelves, Children's Defense Fund. We have seen the desperation that these families are showing and the desperation in not being able to meet basic needs. And we are feeling that desperation, even though others may not be feeling that desperation. And so this $500, or if it's $750 in the governor's budget, it's for basic needs, it's for rent, it's for children's clothes. And we think it's really important, and the TANF dollars are there to make that investment. So thank you very much for your support, and always to Representative Noor for the leadership he's taken on this issue.
Thank you, Ms. Webster, for that testimony. Are there any questions from members? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Noor, TANF pays for the earned income tax credit, child care assistance, and a number of other benefits. And do note that this fund currently has a structural deficit. And although, we experienced reduced expenditures in it in recent months, that has only improved its outlook marginally. I'm wondering if you could speak to the effect that pulling $17 million more out of this would do to the reserves and the prognosis for the TANF account going forward.
Representative Noor.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, I think we need to look into the reserve account. We're talking about the TANF reserve account. This is after we have already allocated some of the programs. And quite frankly, I think the estimate was from last year, we had almost $100 million in that account. And to spend it for this purposes is not going to diminish what is in the account. I don't foresee any structural deficit based on spending $17 million for that purpose. In fact, they are the programs that we are planning to be spending that resources that were brought forward to us. So I would like to ask the nonpartisan staff to just, you know, inform us about that account so that we really understand what we're talking about when we talk about the reserve account, Madam Chair, if you'll allow.
I think Mr. Berg is with us. Mr. Berg?
Madam Chair and members, I was just...
Please state your name and affiliation, okay. And then do you need us to restate the question? Let us know.
No, Madam Chair. I'm Doug Berg. I'm the fiscal analyst for the Human Services Committee. I was just trying to look online very quickly at the February TANF fund statement, and the fund itself, I'm not looking at the governor's recommendations, but the way the fund stands now, there is not a structural deficit in the fund. If you go out to the last year in it is fiscal year 2025, we get the same block grant every year. It is $259,826,000. Projected uses in that year are $206,000. And in looking back, no year from 2018 to 2025 are projected uses greater than the, well, no, I should actually, excuse me 1 minute. They get, the last thing I was going to say is not quite, there is, including transfers for childcare, at the end of the period, the structural deficit is, there's a balance of $553,000 in the last year. There are structural deficits in years 22 through 24 that use up some of the balance. In the last year in 25, there's a structural balance currently in the fund and a bottom line balance of $80 million.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Knorr, we've heard a lot of proposals relevant to assisting the working poor that are out of work. Just an op-ed, and I certainly know that you'll have a comment in response, but my response to a number of these programs, while, you know, they're important to discuss, I think the better way for people to realize a better situation in their life is if we were availing them to get back to work by opening up the economy in a safe manner. I think that we should be focused as much on that perspective in this committee and understanding those ramifications as opposed to one-time checks for the benefit of those. If they could work, I think they would be actually in a better position long term as opposed to a one-time benefit. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Even for those people who work, their wages are so low, they may need assistance, and not just food assistance, but cash assistance as well, or childcare assistance. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yeah, I guess just in the follow leading up from that, interchange with Representative Albright, I'm thinking about the shelter operated at my church in past years that I volunteer at, where we'd have two parents going off to their jobs, even as they're living and experiencing homelessness. So families are really, really struggling. I just wanted to make a comment, I guess, in my capacity as the Early Childhood Committee Chair, just to note the really important child development implications in this proposal and just how critical it is when families are living right on the edge. It's so challenging for families, but recognizing that that has an impact on all the rest of us in the years going forward, at the rate that young kids are developing, an additional payment and support right now to a family can absolutely tip over and provide a support. And so I really appreciate Representative Knorr, you advancing this, and I think it's we should think of it as a child development opportunity as much as anything else. And related to that, too, building on Representative Albright's point, I'll just note that if we want families to be working, we need to provide the support for them to be able to do so. I'm thinking about childcare as being a part of that, but certainly this sort of piece as well, that it's you're really not going to be in position to be able to work and be able to get on a ladder to get your family to self-sufficiency sometimes without just a small bit of help. And so I'm really grateful that this is advancing. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto, for highlighting those important pieces. Representative, I'm not seeing any more questions from members. Representative Knorr, closing comments on your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the engagement and also understanding the need for us to support individuals who are in need, specifically helping them to become more self-sufficient. And truly, this is a program that we can start helping them so they can move on and find employment and to be able to get back to work. But the immediate need is something I think we need to be looking into. Representative Albright, I look forward to working with you on some of other programs that I'm working on to address the use of these resources to support self-sufficiency for families and get them back to work. With that, I ask for your support. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Knorr. So House File 1785, as amended, will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. Members, the last bill on our docket today is House File 1786. House File 1786 will be laid over possible inclusion. Would you like to move the bill, Representative Knorr?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Knorr moves the House File 1786, so it's before our committee. And it looks like you have an A1 amendment. Would you like to describe your amendment?
That's a technical amendment, Madam Chair. It just changes the dates and it puts the bill in the shape that I wanted to present.
Thank you, members. Representative Knorr moves the A1 amendment to House File 1786. This is a voice vote, so please unmute yourself. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Knorr to House File 1786 as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is the same conversation that we're having. I don't know if any one of you has lived in poverty and felt the pain and the suffering that you go through. Some of us have. And to really understand that need is to look at what we are faced with today. One in eight Minnesotans, including one in five in children, are facing hunger today, right here in the state of Minnesota. This bill enables the state to partner with restaurants and nonprofits to prepare and distribute meals to those who are in need. And quite frankly, this is 100% reimbursable under the federal FEMA program. This program is essentially needed to provide approximately 1.5 million meals to those who are right now facing food insecurity impacted by COVID-19. As some of you are aware of, when somebody is isolated, they need that additional help. This program comes into play to help them so they can get the nutrition that they need to be able to get back on their feet. It also helps the restaurants to be able to keep their employees, to have an income, and to get back to normalcy as we struggle with COVID-19 today. Madam Chair and members, for the last 1 year, the Department of Human Services and also Department of Education have partnered with various entities to provide the same program. So there's almost a one-year learning process that will enable the state to take advantage of this program, which is going to be ending by the end of September. This is an opportunity for us to close some of those gaps. These are individuals who may not qualify for some of the other programs because of an incident that may have happened, because of the situation that they find themselves. They can take advantage of this program. It's a win-win situation for the restaurants. It helps us close the food insecurity for so many who are in need today. Madam Chair and members, this program will utilize the emergency service program that has been operational. It works as a rolling process whereby every 3 weeks the funds go out and it's more flexible and allows the Department of Human Services to implement this program. And let's look at what we have learned from the past 1 year. We are almost seeing the light at the end of the tunnel as the vaccines come around. But at this moment, for those who are still struggling, this is a great opportunity that we can provide them that help that they need at this point. So I ask for your support to help put food at the table for so many that need it, and also for the restaurants who are struggling to make ends meet. So thank you, Madam Chair, and ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Noor. And this is looks like it's a $10 million appropriation from the general fund, and you mentioned this will be reimbursed by FEMA. You want to expand on that, Representative Noor?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think from the recent executive orders and from the way the bill is structured and partnering with the restaurants and the way that the meals are going to be distributed, according to many of the advocates, according to the information we had from the previous session, it was 75%. But as of today, the FEMA reimbursement for this program is 100%. And it goes back from January until September 30th. So it's more of a limited time reimbursement that we can really take advantage of and to be able to bank that resources after we've spent. As you all know, that FEMA does not give you the cash upfront. You spend and then request to be reimbursed. And so this program will function like that. So for the $10 million that we will be spending, I'm not sure that we'll get reimbursed for the $1 million that the technical assistance that is included, which we're doing further research on that. But I'm hopeful that we can reimburse that 100% for that $10 million from the general fund.
Thank you, Representative Noor. And have other states have a similar program where they have been reimbursed from FEMA?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. This is something that many states have already put forward, that their resources and spending and then requesting the reimbursement. That's why it went from 75% to 100% at this moment.
Thank you. Representative Bonner.
I just wanted to thank Representative Noor for bringing this forward. And I think you're right. There are so many families, elderly, who are really struggling with groceries and food and access to food. And I just wanted to mention that, you know, in my district, we actually had a program somewhat similar to this. One of our local restaurants who was impacted by COVID decided to start providing meals for local seniors and families in the Osseo community. Lindy's restaurant, in fact, I'd like to give them a good plug for their hard work to make sure that their employees had employment, but also that we were able to serve the needs of the community. They were very blessed in that when the local community heard what they were doing, some of the local businesses, and including the Lions, donated money to help them fund that program. Certainly, with the advantage of having the ability to use FEMA funds to make this same type of thing happen on a larger scale, I really vastly appreciate this. And I can tell you that some of the families in my community who received these services from the local restaurant, you know, this is a family-run restaurant that has been a part of the fabric of our community for so long, and to see them helping neighbors was really incredibly inspiring. And the families who received the assistance were so incredibly grateful and have said that they just don't know how they would have done it without that program. So I just want to thank you, Representative Noor, for finding a way to bring a really innovative idea to scale. I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Noor, first question, and it's a comparison between your earlier bill, 1785, and this one. In 1786, it's a $10 million appropriation, but as Representative Chair Schultz also said, the appropriation allows for the commissioner up to $1 million to administer the grant program. So you're really looking at a possibility of only $9 million for this appropriation. And if you're suggesting that 1.5 million meals are available, so that's $6 a meal, I'm wondering what restaurants would be eligible to provide that food, and have you heard from any restaurants that would be interested in this type of program? And I have one follow-up.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Representative Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Albright. I think this is a program that exists today. And if you look at the Minnesota Central Kitchen, which is operating today, and some of the other programs, that's the exact amount I think we've been spending to provide a nutritious meal for several individuals. I know there are some individuals who are able to testify on that. I don't know who is online at this point to explain in details about the programs that exist right now, Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Noor, if it is an existing program with the conduit and the pipeline already established, why is it necessary for the commissioner to have available $1 million out of the grant when the very purpose of the program is to put food on the tables of people that are suffering from food insecurity, such as you have described? Why does DHS need so much money in order to administer this program when they are only needing $31,000 to administer a program, albeit for just information technology, in your MFIP supplemental proposal?
Representative Noor.
Thank you so much, Representative Albright. I think the program as it exists under the ESP, DHS can provide more details. I see Ms. Sommerfeld, if she wanted to respond to that question.
Ms. Sommerfeld.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jennifer Sommerfeld with DHS, and I don't have an answer right now about what the admin costs are. I know that there's about $1 million for, there's a huge number for programming and changes, and there is, they would have to develop a whole series of contracts with restaurants that we do not have right now, so there will need to be staffing additions in addition to the IT costs.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Sommerfeld, at a time when people need food, as has been proposed by Representative Noor under this, my surprise is at the amount of bureaucracy that you suggest that it has to go through in order for this program to be implemented. And my other question for Representative Noor and or Ms. Sommerfeld, I'll conclude on this, is why is it that we are exempting DHS from state law on this grant management, yet we just heard about the contracts that need to be established to the tune of $1 million at most? And I'll conclude with that question, Madam Chair.
Representative Albright, well, I support getting money right into the hands of families so they can buy food themselves. So it would be better if we could put the $10 million as cash assistance directly to families. But I don't think that that's how the federal FEMA requirements are set up. Representative Noor?
That's exactly right, Madam Chair. I prefer to give that resources through other food process, but the way the program is set up and the way that the emergency services program under DHS is set up allows for some of the exemptions that you talked about, Representative Albright. So this is more about addressing the immediate need to address the food insecurity, not only for those who are eligible for some of the other programs. This is open to anyone and everyone who has got that need. And quite frankly, it's a win-win for restaurants who are struggling deeply. So it is essentially a stimulus for many of those restaurants, and they can provide two things. They get income based on the program, but they also provide the much needed food for those who are in need at this point.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Noor and for Ms. Sommerfeld as well. That wasn't my question. I want to ask it in a different frame. Why does it take $1 million at most to manage the grant under this proposal?
Ms. Sommerfeld?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So as we've been going through this hearing, I've been communicating with staff, and my understanding is the $1 million amount that's in there is in fact not a number that we fiscal noted for the bill. So I don't know that we would need $1 million, I'll be honest with you. So I'm sorry, my apologies for my earlier response. I was misreading something I was seeing come over IM, and I don't have the details, the financial details on this one, so.
Thank you, Ms. Sommerfeld. So we will wait for a fiscal note, Representative Albright, and hopefully.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering if she's. Madam Chair, I'm just wondering if.
Representative Albright.
Thank you. The final question: if Ms. Sommerfeld already knows what she fiscal noted, if she could avail us to that number.
Ms. Sommerfeld.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, we have not done a fiscal note on this bill yet. So I don't know. I would have to check to see if we've been asked to do a fiscal note on this one. But we have, as far as I know, we have not done one yet.
Thank you, Ms. Sommerfeld. We were just reading out of the appropriations in the bill language, Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, she said specifically that that was not the number that they had requested. I'm wondering if she would identify the number that she had requested.
If you leave, Representative Albright, there is no fiscal note yet on this bill. And so we're going to be awaiting that bill. This will be laid over, and when it's, if it's included, we will go through that fiscal note thoroughly. Representative Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Albright, this bill is something that was supported by many stakeholders when we were dealing with the special session in December. In fact, the Senate were involved in that process. Many of the stakeholders signed off on this program. That's how the estimated $1 million as a technical assistance was included in the bill. It was from different stakeholders meeting with us, and also from the Department of MMB and many others who were involved in this process. In fact, there's a whole unit that addresses food insecurity. So I think that was the number that we had, and we used the same language from this special session to this session.
Thank you, Representative Noor. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Noor, and for Ms. Sommerfeld, I apologize if I didn't hear this, but I did ask in terms of why the bill exempts DHS from various sections of the code. Why is that necessary?
Ms. Sommerfeld.
Representative Albright, I am going to have to talk to some staff to get back to you after the hearing, if that's possible.
Thank you, Ms. Sommerfeld. Representative Albright.
That completes my questioning, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Are there any other questions from members? I'm not seeing any. Representative Noor, closing comments. Or I'm sorry, Representative Noor, did you have a testifier, Ms. Webster?
Yes, if Ms. Webster wanted to testify.
Ms. Webster is saying she does not need to testify. Representative Noor, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I think what we need to look into is walk into the shoes of those individuals who are struggling today. And this program and many of the programs that I talked about is to address the poverty that we have in the state of Minnesota. Yes, we can do a lot. And you'll be hearing that, you know, many other programs, but this is critical for us to provide the immediate need so that we can support those families, particularly children who are living in poverty. So this is a simple ask whereby we will be reimbursed at 100%. Yes, we'll be making sure there's some changes to come, and we'll have to make sure that the resources that we're spending goes back into the general fund. So I ask for your support so we can help others who are in need at this moment. So thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you, Representative Noor. So House File 1786 as amended will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. So members, tomorrow we'll be meeting at 10:30. We have another long list of bills to meet committee deadline to hear. So I appreciate coming on time, and you've been doing a great job of getting to committee for the roll call. Appreciate that. I hope you can get out sometime today for at least 5 minutes to feel how warm it is. If not, I'll see everybody on the House floor in 10 minutes. And with that, we are adjourned.